This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The National Mall is a place where encounters happen. Groups of people, many with agendas, cheek by jowl in the most public of public squares.
This is where the Native American elder comes in. He was coming from an Indigenous People's March.
And it was full of prayer, full of promise of a better tomorrow. You know, that was the message we was putting out.
The kids were in D.C. to protest what they see as a national shame. Unaware, perhaps, that Nathan Phillips was too. The shame being the legacy of genocide, to this day depriving Native Americans of adequate clean water, accessible health care, voting rights, protection for Indigenous lands, and more. Which is why Washington Post political columnist Karen Tumulty tweeted the idea that, quote, Covington Catholic High School should organize a spring break project doing service on a Native American reservation for a meaningful encounter, not a glancing one. Tumulty's proposal was roundly criticized as putting the onus on Native Americans to do the work of educating the ignorant mainstream. But presented with deep hatred and racism in their own country, some Indigenous people in Canada came to a very different conclusion.
These six travelers have been invited to experience Indigenous Canada for the next 4 weeks. Other than that, they know nothing about the journey that lies ahead.
First contact from APTN, Aboriginal People's Television Network, is a Canadian documentary series based on an Australian series of the same name. Vanessa Lowen is executive producer of the Canadian version of the show.
There had been a study published that cited that 6 out of 10 Australians had never had contact with Indigenous people. So the producers looked at that and thought maybe if there was more contact, there would be less tensions between the communities.
It was a success. And so 4 years later, 6 white Canadians, Ross, Avon Lee, Don, Ashley, Jamie Sue, and Dallas, were assembled for a full immersion adventure. They came with suitcases and a full complement of ugly Indian stereotypes.
I think of alcoholism. I think of drug abuse,
a whole bunch of partying and flop houses.
They just always get money and handouts.
How are they the worst off when they're given so much?
We are being made to pay for something that we didn't do.
Well, where's my money going?
Over 28 days, they moved through different communities, from assimilated middle-class families to rural Inuit trappers up in Nunavut to urban areas rife with the pathologies of blight. Notably, the visitors learn about Canada's horrifying 120-year history of residential schools, in which Indigenous children were taken from their communities and sometimes actually kidnapped to be transported to boarding schools in order to de-Indian them. The schools were finally shut down about 20 years ago, but they have left generations of trauma. Rick Lightning, a residential schools survivor, now specializing in First Nations awareness, schooled the visitors.
My brother was in residential school, and my sister-in-law were in residential school. They died alcoholics. Whatever happened to them in there, but the effect on their children was unbelievable. My father went to the industrial school in Red Deer. He told me a story. They were working out in the fields, and there was a big hole there, and their bigger boys were bringing in a wheelbarrow, and they dumped it, and there was all these little bodies that fell in there, and one of them was their little brother, David Lightning.
Some of the show's white stars take this information hard, because among the things they came in not knowing was the nature of the education they had signed up for.
We originally sought Canadians with strong opinions, a sense of adventure, and a desire to know more about their own country. We asked them a wide range of questions about different politically charged issues like hunting and environmentalism and Indigenous issues. And then as they got further along through the interview process with our casting team and started to see producers, we started to tell them the show will be focused on Indigenous Canada and Indigenous issues. And at that point, I mean, I imagine in the States with these kinds of race relations, it's similar. People who feel these things are generally not shy. In fact, in Canada, people might be a little bit more shy because we fancy ourselves like really, really polite. And this racism that we experience every day is sort of one of our best kept secrets between Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people. But people are surprisingly unafraid to say these things.
The Native Canadians that your adventurers met along the way were, as a group, just so charming, so thoughtful, so calm, so wise.
But the problem with saving us, they've left us with no religion, no
belief system.
And so that's something that's important to understand, is that we have a way of prayer. Churches didn't bring God here. We had prayer.
Such great exemplars of both the traumas and the triumphs of First Nations people. Was that by design? Was it a tough call?
It was not by design, is all I can say. We picked people who we knew could speak to the community. A lot of the time these people are activists, like Michael Champagne in the first episode, or teachers and elders like Rick Lightning. And these are people that are in our communities. The stereotypes are so deeply embedded in the fabric of Canada that people just choose not to see that there is a whole other side to being Indigenous than what they're seeing in the news and what they're seeing sometimes in their cities.
Well, your six white folks went from significant assimilation on to Nunavut, where they saw a much more traditional lifestyle.
So what would be an example of local food?
Nature.
Seal.
Killaloir.
Whale.
No.
And they also visited a drop-in center for homeless people. They encountered people with drinking problems, ex-felons.
My mom wasn't really around in my life when I was a youth.
Yeah.
So I just was angry about the whole my mom situation, leaving when I was a kid. But it took me to have a drug overdose, and well, I committed my crime, and then I tried to escape from reality.
Not a whitewashed picture of Indigenous life. You could have just created a Potemkin village, but you didn't. Why?
Because with the issues with crime and addiction, those are all things that we understand come out of colonization. And we wanted people to really be able to drill down, A, to see that these people are just people, B, to see that they might have something in common with these people. In the case of Jamie Sue, that really had a profound effect on her because of her own struggles with addiction, meeting these folks with addiction problems and stuff, and really just peeling away the layers that we're all human. The best way to defeat racism is through education, and so many people choose not to be educated because it's just easier to read the headlines and move on and have your strong opinions and think you're right. So this was our one opportunity to educate and make people have a little bit of empathy for their Indigenous community.
But there was some backlash from the First Nations communities.
I think that they felt like, why is it our responsibility to make the non-Native population of Canada understand that we're just people? We're sick of having to do this. Why do we have to keep doing this? I will say that in the case of Michael Champagne, he was initially asked to be on the show and said, there's no way in hell I'm doing this. And he said, like, why would they even think that I would want to be a part of this? This is crazy. And then he sat back and really thought about it and was like, I have a responsibility to my community to help educate and help build this bridge. And he did it. And now I see Michael all the time. We live in the same city. He says it was a completely valuable experience, and he's so glad that he let his guard down and put himself in that situation.
At the end, the transformations are uneven. At one extreme, you have one of the women, Jamie Sue, and a young guy named Dallas, who actually see themselves now as advocates and allies of the Indigenous community.
I want to be part of the solution, and I don't want to be part of the problem. And you can also classify the problem as silence. The fact that there's six of us sitting here talking about it right now is a really good step forward.
And on the other end, there's these two guys, Ross and Don, who from the beginning have been almost caricatures of stubborn old white guys who believe what they believe and they just won't be budged.
I'm still skeptical about the whole school thing because it was all, they stole our kids. They ruined our families. They took us all away.
That was the thing to focus on. It's not focusing on.
The connotation of that is it was a violent taking of all the children away from the families.
It's not focusing on. They took their culture. They took their language away.
No, you can't take someone's culture.
You
can teach them a new culture. And
for the purposes of reality show drama, were you assuming or even hoping that they'd stay in character to the bitter end?
At no point did we approach this series as though it was a reality show. I know that it inherently falls within the genre, but we were treating it as a documentary series where we wanted to document their true experiences, and we were not manufacturing them. The only thing that we were aware of was everybody has to undergo psychological testing, obviously. We can't send people for 28 days to remote areas and risk someone being not well. As a result of the psychological testing, we knew that some people would have more of a propensity for change than others. But, of course, none of that is a given. Anything could have happened. And I will say, Ross, who really seemed not to change, and even though that, you know, is I think, true of who he is, after he met some of the inmates from his area, he went back that Christmas and took them gifts as a way to show them support and continue to encourage them on their journey towards making their life better. So while he maybe didn't change in his opinions that he spouts to people, he certainly felt a connection.
The show, which started on APTN, a network explicitly for Indigenous peoples, it now has a lot of mainstream distribution. What's the reaction been?
Well, we certainly always struggle with getting eyeballs on what we're creating out of the Indigenous community. There's a mentality of that's for them and not for us. With First Contact, we were actually quite hopeful that it would reach the mainstream. And most of our feedback is from non-Indigenous people. Now we have been bombarded in a good way for requests for educational packages. So we're working on creating a curriculum that will accompany the educational videos that are being distributed by our distributor. I mean, I just had a call this week from women from a religious organization in Ontario who were organizing screenings for their communities. That's really the response that stays. The responses of the militancy or the this is all lies or I'm sick of hearing about residential schools, those comments certainly came and then they quickly fell away. Those people haven't stuck around. And that's all that we care about. What we care about is that there's going to be a long tail of this teaching that can be taken forward for hopefully generations.
Well, Vanessa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Vanessa Lowen is an executive producer of the Canadian version of First Contact. For Canadians, First Contact is set against a backdrop of pain and, more recently, reconciliation. Here's former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper in a special joint session of the House of Commons and the Senate in 2008.
Mr. Speaker, I stand before you today to offer an apology to former students of Indian residential schools. The treatment of children in Indian residential schools is a sad chapter in our history.
Harper's apology for this dark century of Canadian history was followed by the founding of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which ultimately released its conclusions in 2015.
For more than 6 years, the commission traveled the country, hearing from survivors. Nearly 38,000 say they experienced physical or sexual abuse.
The hope of our commission for reconciliation in the future is that we as adults can make a commitment to the children of the future, that we will do what we can today to make their world of tomorrow a better place.
The report set forth 94 recommendations, including the right to mass media. APTN, which was founded in 1999, became a fundamental piece of the reconciliation process. Jean LaRose is CEO.
Well, our mandate is basically to share our stories amongst ourselves because we are not one people in Canada. You have First Nations, you have Inuit, you have Métis peoples, so we better know each other, but also share it with all Canadians. Canadian experience has been to create a false image, a stereotype of Native people in Canada. I remember my grade 5 school book showed us as semi-naked savages, dirty, unkempt, full of lice. So all Canadians have this image of who we are, this stereotype, but the reality of it is across the country, our communities and our peoples are involved in every facet of life. We have engineers, we have politicians, we have ministers in the cabinet, we have people across everywhere in industry that are making a huge contribution and huge difference in this country. So for us to be still perceived as either the noble savage or the drunken savage is something that needs to be addressed.
On the other hand, your channel isn't just a propaganda channel highlighting the nobility part of the stereotype. Part of truth and reconciliation is truth, and you do not turn your cameras away from chronic problems of an underclass, from transgenerational trauma, from dysfunctional families, from dysfunctional lives. And there's backlash attached to that from Indigenous communities. There are people who believe that you are yourselves portraying a side of Indigenous life that they would prefer not to advertise to the world. They think you're self-defeating. How big a problem is that for you?
I say it would be a bigger problem when we started turning the lens on ourselves about 10 years ago. The backlash then was quite strong. But we're seeing a change in our communities. We're seeing a change in the leadership. There is a younger leadership, but there's also leadership that wants to be more accountable, that wants to be more transparent, slowly moving into place. So we're having less of that backlash than we did when we first started. What we're seeing is that the actual community members will tell us, thank you for telling that story because we didn't dare. For example, APTN had a series called Blackstone that ran for 5 years. It created a fictional First Nation. The plot started off by portraying everything that was bad in a community, about the leadership, about the politics, about everything else.
Last season on Blackstone.
Gun registered to your name is found at the crime scene.
A woman has gone missing.
I'm all alone!
And now, a sizzling new season of Blackstone begins.
And initially, we were severely criticized for portraying ourselves in a bad light. But the goal was, over the course of the series, to show how the community could start taking matters into their own hands. People could start making their voices heard. They could start pushing for change. We started getting a lot of support for it to the point that when we ended the season, we got criticized for stopping it. So it did, for many people, create that aspirational viewpoint that things can be better, but we have to be part of the solution. We can't sit there and expect things to happen for us. We've done that for 150 years. It doesn't work. We've got to take matters into our own hands and make our lives better. And we believe that APTN is part of that transition and helps people sort of focus on the broader picture and not just today's reality.
Well, Jean, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jean LaRose is Chief Executive Officer of APTN. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Feder, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chaturvedi. We had more help from Zandra Ellen and Alice Maiden, and our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Sam Baer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.